Welcome back to Silk Flowers and
Paper Mache Hearts. We are your hosts, Eric Hart
and Ashley Flowers, and today we are finishing up our conversation with Sandy Strawn. Thank you for coming back.
Thanks. Glad to be back.
So for those of you who don't know, Sandy has written The Properties Director's Toolkit, a book about being a professional properties director. And I think that's the second edition because it was previously called The Properties Director Handbook until it was sort of absorbed into Focal Press's toolkit line of books. And before that, it was a website, thephandbook.com, going back. So it's had a long history. But as far as I know, this was the first book about professional properties management. Mm-hmm. Because before this, they were kind of all about building props, or you might get like, hey, stage managers, this is how you do props for a show, or mm-hmm. here's a chapter in a book yeah. about doing a prop. So, and I think last episode you were talking about you needed a textbook to teach it.
Well, and it all started actually with Michael Gillette, and he wanted an update to his chapter on props for his theater production and design book. And he had sent me the galleys for it, and I looked at it, and I was just like, oh, no, that isn't. Can I rewrite a lot of this? And he was like, yeah, send me your ideas. And so I sent him, I just regurgitated on the page and sent him a whole bunch of stuff. And he was like, oh, this won't fit into a chapter, Sandy. This is way more than a chapter. And so I was like, you know what? I'm going to spam. And that year it was at Utah. And I said, let me take it to the spam folks and let me talk with them about what should be in this chapter. And mm-hmm. I'll come back to you. And he was like, great, that's fine. You've got, 6 weeks to get me something. And I was like, okay. I took it to spam and we broke into groups and we said, what needs to be covered? What is the important thing about prop lists? What do we want to talk about in this chapter to update it? And I'm telling you, I got the best information. Everybody was so on board and they were so excited about it. And we went through what Michael had written and just crossed off stuff that seemed out of date or maybe just needed to be freshened. And that's how that chapter evolved. And I had so much information then. After that, I started incorporating it in my class because I had like 35 prop list examples and I had all these different ways to solve the same problem, basically. Mm-hmm. And I thought, oh, this is really interesting. And I could start to see some things that coalesced, some parts of management style and maybe protocols for creating calendars or for managing a prop list. And I was like, I should try to codify this into a style of management that could be taught.
Yeah.
And so that's where it came from. And I actually, I was just like, I'm going to use this as my own teaching. I wasn't thinking about writing a book. I wasn't none of that. And I showed it to a friend of mine who was also teaching or was trying to teach a class and was really stymied. And I said, well, this is what I use here. I'll send you all my stuff. Mm-hmm. And he wrote me back and said, oh, can you put this into a booklet form of some kind that I could hand out? And I was like, oh, okay. So I said, how about I just build a web page? And then you could just have the students access it there. So that's what I did. So a couple of years passed and I actually sent it to Focal Press, that thing that you send out that says, I have an idea for a book. Mm-hmm. And I got this lovely letter back saying, yeah, no, thanks. We're going to pass.
Oh, no.
Okay. And I thought, okay, fine. This is cool. I didn't really plan on having it a book. It's already written and it's up on the webpage. Well, then your book was coming out, Eric, mm-hmm. and they contacted me and said, hey, we need somebody to review this proposal. Would you be interested? And I'm like, yeah, sure. So I'm reviewing Eric's proposal. And I think I actually asked you, Eric, who are you talking to at Focal Press? And you were like, oh, contact this person. So I did. And they were like, oh, well, send us your proposal for this. And I go, okay. So I did. And they were like, oh, we love your book. Yes, we should publish it.
That's awesome.
And they actually had looked at the website and they were like, everything's already here. It's already been written. All of the figures are here. Basically, you just have to download them and put them into a book form. And so, yeah. So thank you, Eric, because without you, probably it would never have happened as a book.
Yeah.
And then from there, I don't know if you have this experience, but you read it and you just go, oh, that's clunky, or now 5 years, 6 years have passed, and you know, we don't have to talk about what is the internet and how to do search function on the internet to such a depth. And we need to talk about communication through Google Hangout, through all the different ways that we now function really electronically, and the way we share files and the way we share information. Mm-hmm. That has to all get updated. So that's when they then said, why don't you write it in for the toolkit series? We added a new chapter because Lisa Schlenker came on board as my co-writer, and we added a chapter on doing co-pros. We updated weaponry. We updated, you know, throughout the book. So it's a pretty big update. And that's the last time I will update it.
Right.
that's it.
After this, it'll be Lisa's problem, and she can find another co-writer, and she can update it.
Oh. I think it's a feature of all the toolkits, but there's interviews in there too with props professionals.
Yeah. And I really wanted to do that. And it that came about because I was in the same car with Deb Morgan driving to the airport as we left Houston. And she and I got to talking about the fact that she's basically a freelancer and does the work with the opera. And I went, I want to interview you and put that in my book. And can I send you like 15 questions we need to know? And so from there, we leaped off. And then we had, you know, five or six people that are also interviewed then as sort of these little chapter drop-ins between. And I think it adds a real specific professional attitude about how all the different ways you can do props, from movie and film to children's theater, main stage American Regional Theater in the Lort area, to being a freelancer, education, all of that. So I love the interviews.
That's awesome.
Yeah, I really like them too.
I have had a lot of wonderful feedback from people who use the book. Weirdly enough, the webpage still is getting used
the
time. And I get queries from all over the world. People who say, this is so cool. And I'm in Lyon, France, and I'm trying to teach this. Can I download and use? And I'm like, well, you can download or you can buy the book, and it's more up to date.
I'm always sending people to the website because it's like, check out the website now and then order the book, and while you're waiting for it to arrive you can use the website.
That's right.
And you know how difficult it is to keep a website up to date. So it's probably will be phased out in a little bit here because it's just falling behind. And I have not updated it with the prop toolkit stuff. So
So everybody buy the book if you don't already.
Yes. Buy the book. Prop toolkit. Yeah.
That's a great
book. What would you say your other like big highlighted moments in this book that you talk about, or topics I should say?
The one I think I get the most queries about is communication. And I think every theater struggles with communication. It has gotten much easier. Now that people use, you know, the web to communicate with, and you can track emails, and you get, I mean, I get stage manager notes the same day as it comes out. You used to have to wait. They would have to print them off. They would put them in where the mailboxes were. You'd take the notes out. You'd read them. You'd write your response. You'd stick, you know, that doesn't happen anymore.
Yeah.
You know, it's all done electronically. So there's almost an instantaneous communication with rehearsal. The same thing with designers. You know, you can now take a photo when you're standing in the antique store and send them and say, hey, I found this. Would this work for that piece? Okay, how much do you want to spend on this? I think we can go up to $250. So that whole level of communication and how you address that, what are the protocols for proper etiquette on the web? How do you track what has been said? How do you keep your prop list updated so the most current information is still there? That I think people know maybe it's some part in their head, but they don't understand how to do it. And when they read through the book, it's sort of broken into step by step of how I do it and how I keep organized, because props is all about organization.
Yes, very true.
And if you keep that Bible, whether it's electronically or you have a hard copy or whatever level of prop work you're in, if you're in community theater to regional Lort theater to Broadway to film, it's having the information available so that you can make smart choices and make good design decisions, communicate that to rehearsal, working with the designer and the director so they know what's going on, communicating with your staff so they know what the up-to-date information is. It's management, communication, mm-hmm. creativity. It's just keeping on top of it all. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And that's what the whole book is kind of about. It's about managing collaboration, communication, creativity.
That's yeah. Awesome. Yeah, definitely. I used to use the website. I mean, I'll go there. I really like the props list from other companies.
Places. Yeah.
That's always really great. Especially when I was getting started. It's like, what do I do? Okay. This is what they do. This is how they do yep. it. Great. Oh, and here's the list of what's in a props Bible. That's great. You know, kind of like all these little checklists and like this, right, this distillation right. of all the information. Like I was kind of doing this, so it's nice to have a backup that what track. I was doing was right. And there's also like a couple tips to improve it. I'm not like way out in left field. with what I'm doing.
Well, I think so much of what we do is a lot of people do start as assistants and then they move into that prop master position or props director position. And unless you've kind of been aware or been observing, yeah, you may not know how to do it necessarily. So I've tried to provide a bit of a directory or a toolkit so that you can go there and sort of say, well, what are some examples or how do I track these props? Awesome. How do I communicate with stage management?
And you're also working on a new book now, right?
I'm struggling, yes, with a new book.
And it's about Paul Owen.
And Paul Owen was the resident designer first at the Alley Theater back at the start of regional theater in America. Mm-hmm. He came on actually as an actor and then eventually transitioned to sort of, I would say designer, but at that point, he would, yes, design the shows. But he would also, which is what we were joking about earlier, you know, you use the same skill set, whether you're an actor, whether you're he was trained a technician, whether you're a props person, you analyze script for character, yeah. for place, for time and mood, for what am I trying to evoke? Mm-hmm. And he stayed at Actors Theatre of Louisville for many years into the new building. And at the new building, it was just so mammoth and so huge and so different. And it's a painful story for Paul because everything changed and Nina changed, artistic director, because it was just overwhelming. Mm-hmm. And so he eventually had to leave. He just couldn't stay. Mm-hmm. Their relationship deteriorated to where he was not helping he didn't feel that it was going forward in the way that they had hoped. So he actually quit theater and he moved to North Carolina to go be an architect and started designing houses. And he stayed there for a while, really just trying to figure out his life. Well, the resort that he was working for couldn't get the funding. It was in a bad economic time. And so Actors Theatre of Louisville had just hired John Jory, who was working, if you can believe, month to month, they didn't have enough money to kind of get ahead. They were still in the train station, which was literally the old train station that was down on the riverbanks. And the train tracks still ran quite close. So, yeah. And they were like, oh, yeah, we need somebody to do lights and costumes and stuff. And so we think you'd be a good costume designer. Mm-hmm. And he'd been doing costumes and lights and scenery at the Alley, oftentimes all three. And so he went in as the costume designer. Kurt Wilhelm came in to do costumes for one show, and Mary Lou, who was Paul's wife, was running the costume shop, and they hit it off, and he was so amazed. He said, I'm quitting my job in teaching, and I'm going to come work full-time here as your costume designer.
Oh, wow.
So Paul went over to scenery and lights, and, you know, 50-some years later, he's still there.
Yeah.
No, he's not there 50-some years. But he stayed there for the rest of his career. And loved working there. It was the best of times for him. It was an amazing opportunity. It was when resident regional theater was really sort of starting to bloom past the Guthries and the Cleveland Playhouse and the Alley Theater. So it was going to the secondary, the smaller locations. And Actors Theater was one of what they call those acorn theaters. And the theater was condemned because they were putting a highway through where the theater was.
Mm-hmm.
So he's like, oh no, here we go again. Well, long story short, they did find a building and they moved to it, which was an old bank building. They bought the land adjacent to it. That's where they put the new theater, which was behind the bank building. They bought an adjacent four-story department type store, and that became the offices and the production studio areas. And on the very top was the Victor Joy Theater, which was a small little black box theater. So they had the Pamela Brown, which was a thrust stage theater, a minor thrust, not a deep thrust, and then the Victor Joy upstairs. And Paul was the scene designer, lighting designer for years and years and years and years and years, and retired when he had a clash with management about who owns the right to control the staff, really. And that's because Paul came from a time when there really weren't production managers. There really weren't all those layers of administration that are now in there. And they let go of the technical director without even talking to him.
Oh, wow.
And the teeth for a scene designer is like his right hand. It would be like letting go of the prop master, who's his left hand. You know, it's like you wouldn't do that. Paul really feels that the people who work there are his people. They're his people. And he protects them. He cares for them. And he, the new play festival would have not happened, in my opinion. It just wouldn't have happened, because five shows on the main stage and four shows up in the Victor Jory, and pretty much the same size staff with a few additional overhires. And all of those shows had to work together and they had to change out. Sometimes we would have a show in the afternoon. There'd be a different show in the evening. And then after that, there might be some 1X that played on a bare stage. So you had to be able to change all of that out. And he designed it all like a intricate Chinese puzzle, so it all fit together and worked together. And famously, was one time he was asked by a New York critic what the trick was in order to make the season work, and Paul said one word: storage. Because it's like, where do you store all this stuff? And we would produce fully produced shows, and you know, gigantic things that were just fully dressed out. And you're just thinking, oh my God. And, And, but on, then on the side, he's also, you know, at the same time he's doing that, he's doing Shakespeare in the summers, and he's designing his house, and he's an expert on iris and, daylilies, and he has this huge garden that I mean, he's a Renaissance man.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
No, so he has a beautiful house.
I caught up with him at a event that they were having to honor him when they named the production studio after him, and found out that all of his bottles and all of his drawings and everything were sitting in his garage, which appalled me. And I went then back and I would interview him, and we would look at drawings, and I would archive stuff and try and get things organized. And he had it in a pretty good shape. And so, then my job after that, I thought, this has to find a home.
Yeah.
I think we're losing our history. The history of especially designers and especially designs, because we have this whole body of new American plays that have been developed in the last 60 years of resident theater. And who solved that first problem? And how is it done? And that's the thing about spam we constantly run into, is who has done this show and how was it solved?
Yeah.
I think the same thing is true of designs, is how did you solve this problem? And as the kind of design over moves and changes from abstract to realistic to semi-realistic, and people approach that same script with a different lens, but the bones, the foundation is the same. And I, as a designer, have oftentimes done plays that I know Paul has done. And I am not too proud to say that I go, well, how did Paul solve that problem? Okay. Oh, I see how he's doing the entrances. I see how he's doing that scene change. It won't work for me because I'm in a completely different theater. And it kind of gives me like a cheat sheet on it. So then I can sort of think, how would I solve it in a different way, perhaps?
Yeah.
So that's what I wanted to save. Mm-hmm. And fortunately, I was able to talk with the University of Louisville in Delaware, in Louisville, and they accepted his entire design archive, and it's now protected in climate-controlled storage. And they have Actors Theater of Louisville. I spoke to them and I said, "Do you have the models?" Because I knew that they had a lot of models that were in these huge boxes, and they'd all been labeled, and there were like pictures on the outside, but it had been moved about. I knew there had been floods and famines and locusts, and but yes, they did have some of the models. And so I went back and tried to restore the ones I could restore. I've documented them, and then they donated them to the archive. So Paul's models are there. There's probably 15, 17 models.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
And drawings of probably 100 and 200 shows. But he's done over 1,000 productions.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's insane.
Crazy. Yeah. Because that's all the Humana festivals.
Yeah. You open those Humana festivals and you look at the floor plans and you're just like, how did these play on the same stage?
Mm-hmm.
And until you start to look at the specific plates after that, you go, oh, I see that that flat turns around and becomes this door. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, you start to see the Oriental puzzle and how he solved it.
Mm-hmm.
But other times it was just Paul parked big semis in the parking lot, and it was literally low to show out, low to show in, low to show out, low to show in. So, yeah, crazy. So I'm trying to document that. Yeah. That's the book.
Yeah.
But as you can imagine,
it's probably a lot to go through.
And I'm a prop person. I'm really good with my hands. I could build a prop. I'm not sure I can write this book, but I'm working on it.
Yeah.
And I have great interviews with Paul. I've been interviewing for a decade, so lots
That's
of
amazing.
Great stories. Great stories.
Well, it's such a distinct period of American theater that he was kind of there at the beginning. And I feel like he was one of the last resident scene designers as well, because those were being phased out in the 90s and the early 2000s. There weren't any theaters that had resident scene designers or resident designers, and he was still there. I mean, I was there in 2006 at the new production suite, and he had an office right in the front, right next to the prop master, right next to the TD. He's in there with his assistants designing. So it could be like, hey, there's a new prop there.
And Brenda,
can we get
building,
a drawing?
When building his models.
Yeah. So you go in and you ask for a drawing, and a few hours later, he has a drawing and a model piece, and you can now build this new prop.
Exactly. And that adjacency was so amazing. You know, that ability to just walk. Well, when I was there, you'd walk up the stairs and you'd just say, hey, Paul. It's not done anymore. Nobody does it anymore. And I don't understand why. I look at it and I go, wouldn't that be easier? But I think part of it is they want bigger names. They want more.
Yeah.
There's people that tend to work with designers that they like and they want to have that same connection. So directors and designer packages almost come in now. So it has changed. I don't know of any. I just don't know of any company that has a resident anymore.
Right. Yeah.
If they do, they may only do two or three shows in the season, and then the rest is designed by outside. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So they're not really resident. They're kind of longer term guest artists.
Yeah. Yeah. Or I've seen some places that have a resident assistant scene designer.
So really?
Yeah. You go in and then you got an assistant there. Yeah.
What is that?
Yeah. Well, there's a lot with continuity too, because I don't know how many times we have a designer come in and then you're like, well, you know, that thing in the drawing is actually this weird HVAC thing that you can't put any scenery against, but you don't know that because you're not here. And this is the biggest thing where it fit through the hall because of this weird jog in the stairs. So you can't design anything bigger than that.
The sightlines issue, you know, if you've designed in a theater, after you've designed there like two or three times, you go, oh, there's that weird sightline thing and there's that. Well, Paul designed the theater that they're in, so he knows what the theater does. And he understands its faults, and he understands how you can manipulate it to make it look like it's really, really deep, even though it's only like 18 feet. You know, he had all those tricks because he'd solved that problem so many times. He knew how to design. And you look at how his design changed over time and how he became in my opinion, just more competent as a designer and more comfortable in designing for that particular theater. Mm-hmm. I mean, I was 27 years at the university and designing for the main stage. And I'm telling you, you get a little tired of solving the same problem on that same theater. Well, he was there twice that length. So mm-hmm. I'm just like, how do you do that? How do you stay right. fresh? And yet you look at those designs and you're just like, damn, mm-hmm. he loved it. That was his life. Mm-hmm. He loved it.
That's amazing.
So we'll see. I'm working on it.
I can't wait for it. I'm sure yeah. it'll be a few years.
But right. it sounds like it's going to be yeah. great.
One of those giant coffee table books, maybe a pop out model in the middle.
Oh my gosh, be awesome. You know, you said that and I thought of the perfect design for that.
Oh my gosh, that would be so cool.
Yeah, I'm like, oh my god, that one up in the Victor Jory that just had the hanging piece and it had the floor plan of the theater. Oh, I was like, I know the perfect design that would yes. pop out.
That would be amazing. How perfect. I love it.
Well, and to just be at that cutting edge of all the new plays because of the Humana Festival, mm-hmm. He's designed the first take on that play for hundreds of plays, mm-hmm. hundreds of plays.
I know I was looking through the ones you had worked on with him, and it's like Crimes of the Heart. You had done the first one, which is still remains like such a prop heavy show. And it's like you had to solve it without being able to go to a group. I mean, how do you light 30 birthday candles at once? How do you?
Yeah, there's a lot. There were a lot of plays. And Paul's hands-on in the prop shop. So he would do what we called his afternoon strolls, where he would, you know, where he'd walk through the shop. What are you working mm-hmm. on? How's it going? Mm-hmm. And give you direct feedback on everything that's going on. And it was a lovely working situation, and especially on a new play where you don't have any prior, there's nobody to call. Mm-hmm. You're just solving it. And it was the start of a lot of what I call TV scripts on stage, mm-hmm. you know?
Yeah.
Where this like, yeah, this is really a TV show, but okay. Yep. And they would ask for things that you can't do because you can't say, oh, well, you know, let's splatter blood everywhere. And then, oh, the lights go down, the lights come up, and it's perfectly clean. You know, they aren't stopping the camera. It's like, how do we solve this? You know, it's so a lot of that kind of problem solving was what really happened in those early days and figuring it all out. But what fun. Right? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Best times. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. So much fun. Just like when you have it's like, it's a challenge. And I'm like, okay. This is going to take a while, but I'm going to get there. It's like, I love it. So switching gears real quick, you have worked in several countries.
Tours. I did tours, yeah. And that was all through Actors Theater as well. Uh-huh. And they got involved with the USIA information. So it was about taking American culture to other countries. Uh-huh. So tour to Greece, tour to, you don't want to be doing those. If anything, it cured me of touring, of nothing else. I'm like, never tour again. To see a lot of interesting theater. And when you go to those theater festivals, like up in Toronto or places where other companies were, you got to see what other places were doing and more certainly than what we could produce at Louisville, because it's a pretty conservative audience. And John Jory, as the artistic director, would push that boundary. So it was lovely mm-hmm. to go and see other countries and to go have the chance to produce theater there and work in theater and do things. And my most recent sort of venue off the tracks was teaching for a week at American University in Cairo, where I did some workshops on mask making. And
I'm so jealous. I am obsessed with Egyptian
Well, the
cultures.
Great thing is, oh, that's wonderful. I don't have it on. I was going to show you my ankh, but I don't have it. So, my partner is Egyptian. So, Egypt is a fabulous and wonderful place, and you should go there, and it's safe to visit, and I encourage you to visit and to go. Theater is not a big part of their world, but storytelling is, and that's nothing. Mm-hmm. Storytelling is just theater without all the scenery, you know? Mm-hmm. It's the same thing. But I was at American University in Cairo for, they were producing a play. And so I got to props master and work with the guy who ran the scene shop. And what was really great was, you know, be like, oh, we need this cargo net that has to get thrown out. And he was like, I will take you to the rope area. So I'm like, okay, we go to this part and, you know, you're driving through these little streets in Cairo and then you get to this and all it is shop after shop after shop of people making rope and nets and, oh yeah. And then it's like, I will take you to the fabric area. I will take you to the, oh, it was awesome.
That's amazing.
And they took these, we needed AK-47, so we cast an AK-47. Then we took it to this metal air, cast these aluminum AK-47 models. It was just crazy, just nuts. I mean, a whole totally different way of doing theater. And that's, you know, that's what I love about experiencing other countries and other ways of doing it. Because, I mean, they taught stagecraft, but the first time I went in and I'm used to running my shop. I have a very Western mentality. Yeah. I walk up the table's on, I'm switching on, getting ready, and it's late, no, don't. And I'm like, okay. And it's like, only men run tablecloths. And then really only the guy in the shop. And so I was like, oh, okay. Well, so then I helped him run the piece plywood through, and he kind of stood there for a while and he goes, you know what you do? And I went, yeah. And so he gestured to the table saw. We finished running it with me pushing it through. And then it was like, you are okay. You run table saw. So I was like, okay. Women's live in Egypt.
That's amazing.
It was fun. But I don't know that it was that weird, but it maybe was just, you know, the fact he didn't know me or whatever.
Oh, yeah.
And English. But I never saw another woman in the shop, and I never saw anybody else run the table saw. So, but it was lovely. I had a wonderful time there, and I would go back in a heartbeat. Yeah.
Oh, take me with you.
It was fun. Well, then the nice thing is, you know, you're like, well, I'm in Egypt. I might as well do the Nile cruise and might as well go over to Alexandria and see the library there. And I tried to get a library card, but I didn't have a local address, so they wouldn't let me get a library card. And I was like, oh. So that's another benefit of being in theater. You get to travel and see things around the world or around the country. I've been on state tours and yeah, you know, it's like, oh, good, we're in Paducah, Kentucky, and we're unloading burgers. And it was so lovely. We were doing, I can't even remember the name of the show, but afterwards, this people came up afterwards, and they went, well, we just loved your show. It was like Fiddler on the Roof, only faster.
That's amazing.
Okay. So we all had t-shirts made up, like Fiddler on the Roof, only faster. Those were our loadout shirts.
Mm-hmm. That's amazing.
Oh, my God.
I love it.
The things you take me back to.
Well, unfortunately, we're out of time again. I feel like we could talk for hours and hours about everything. We'll have to have you back on the show for sure. Thank you so much for joining us. It's been such a pleasure, Sandy.
Thank you so much. I've enjoyed it.
And everybody, thank you for listening in. And make sure to follow us on Twitter at Silk Mache and email us with any questions or ideas at propspodcast@gmail.com and subscribe to us on iTunes, Google Play, and Spotify.
And check out our website at silkflowersandpapermachehearts.com where you can find all of our old episodes as well as a link to our Patreon page. With Patreon, you can sign up to donate a small sum on a monthly basis to help support this podcast. And if you donate over a certain amount, we will thank you personally at the end of every episode. Thank you, Jay Duckworth, for your continued support.
This has been another episode of Silk Flowers and
Paper Mache Hearts with your hosts, Eric Hart
and Ashley Flowers. Thanks for joining in.
Goodbye.